poem of Sigmund and Anna Freud's. I was telling Carol earlier that, in a sense, this poem is responsible for rescuing psychoanalysis. Not just Anna and Sigmund, but the psychoanalytic traditions that would otherwise have been lost. And so, just, you know, I set off the alarm earlier because I was leaning too forward to try to see and see what we touch. So it's, you know, it's full of meaning and emotion for me. And you all are lucky to have it in your backyards, but for a New Yorker, it's quite something. Okay, so let me first start with telling you just a little bit about why I wrote this. In the spirit of postmodern subjectivity, I'm somebody who grew up with the past and the present. I'm the grandchild of European Jews, some of whom were emigres or survivors or victims. And even though I was an American child in 1960s New York, at my dinner table, people talked a lot more about Vichy and collaborators and concentration camps than they did about Vietnam or civil rights or all the things that most people were talking about. I think typically my family, like so many trauma victims, were preoccupied with what had happened to them. Trauma, by definition, being so impossible to mentalize, so overwhelming, so excessive. And what I have found, and it's not just me, it's studies have shown that there tends to be extremes, especially for people who haven't had a chance to work through their trauma, where they're either obsessed or silent. And because trauma haunts you. And the American poet Emily Dickinson said, you don't have to be a house to be haunted. So then as I grew up and became a psychoanalyst, I started to realize that my other family, my psychoanalytic family, was similar enough to my family of origin to make me wonder, how did this affect them? I mean, I could not think of one influential psychoanalyst, except maybe Winnicott, who comes to mind because I'm in London, who didn't suffer the scourge of the Shoah, even whether it be immigration or internment, or even if they left earlier than 1938, 1939, they had family that had suffered, and they'd lost their homelands. So I began to think that, how did this affect them? I know how it affected me and my interests. By the way, I am trained in New York as an interpersonal analyst, which is in America, where, in large part due to Anna Freud, when I was in training, the Freudian model was the model. It was the only model. It was the mainstream. And I instead went to an institute where the focus was much more on culture and milieu than the inner life and psychosexual theory. And I'm sure it's because on some level I sensed that my milieu had an enormous amount. I mean, those things can be bifurcated in a way that's not natural or helpful, but that was what I veered towards. So I asked to myself, how did these people, these analysts, Freud, Anna Freud, but all of the people who came to America, Hartman, Chris, Lowenstein, all Jews who escaped the Shoah, how did their theories change or not change based on this catastrophic, traumatic experience that had to in some way haunt them? And, you know, I thought the same thing about the British. I thought the same thing about the French. I thought the same thing about the Israeli analysts. You know, Max Eitingen, who was really Freud's financier, he started the Berlin Institute, and which became the jewel in Freud's crown before the 1933, and actually Freud preferred to Vienna, which he thought was a backwater. And then was taken, you know, ironically, cruelly and ironically, was taken over by Matthias Gorin, who was Martha Gorin's cousin, but was really the place called Abraham, Melanie Klein, Wilhelm Reich, where psychoanalysis was making its greatest strides. Eitingen left when the Nazis took power and went to Israel, which disappointed Freud. He wanted him to go to Prague at the time, but he went to Israel, and he started the Jerusalem Institute, which many people used to refer to as the third Berlin generation. So I studied them too. But since I'm here, and I spoke to lots of people, many of whom, I got to speak to Martin Bergman. I don't know how many of you are a famous Freud scholar who just recently died. I was lucky enough to visit with him. Otto Kernberg. I spoke to Tony Chris, who's Ernst Chris's son. But since I'm in London, at the Freud Museum, I'm going to talk to you about my chapter of my book about England. And one of the things I'm going to say is that I think context really matters. Context matters enormously to how we think, what we think. Context matters enormously to our theories. And I would like to suggest that that context determines not just what we include, but also what we omit. So let me start, and I want to leave time for discussion. I know there are probably people here who know at least as much, if not more, than I do about this topic, and I welcome dialogue, and I'm very interested in your point of view, so I'll stop if I just have to stop. So, you know, when Hitler marched into Vienna in 1938, as I implied, the geographical and interpersonal map of psychoanalysis was changed forever. Many of you probably know that the Gestapo impounded the Freud's possessions. They brought Anna to the headquarters, where she also took a cyanide pill with her in case they didn't let her go. They extorted large sums of money from the family, in addition to Marie Bonaparte's ransom. Along with some of their Central European colleagues, they found refuge at Melanie Klein's dominant voice in London. Now, the theoretical differences between Freud and Klein date back to the 20s, but they only intensified enormously when the groups shared a city and an institute, essentially. And as you know, Sigmund Freud died in 1939, and less than a year after moving to this very house, and Anna Freud took his standard as heir apparent. Now, let me just tell you a little bit of something more about what was going on around them, around what the controversies I'm going to be discussing. So the year 1940 marked the beginning of the London Blitz. But the émigrés, who were classified as enemy aliens, were not permitted to escape to the countryside, nor to join the army, as so many of their English colleagues had done. And on the other hand, therefore, the émigrés became a sudden majority at the Institute meetings, and became bent upon developing their own theories during this period. Friction then only intensified doubly when Klein and her followers returned in 1941 as the attacks on the city eased. And that all culminated in what we know as psychoanalysts, and probably some of you know, as the controversial discussions, when there just became heightened disagreements about theory. Klein thinking she was the true heir to Freud, the true Freudian, and of course Anna feeling that she was really the standard bearer. And this controversy was preceded by controversial business meetings. And can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
And controversial business meetings, okay, are actually recorded. The minutes of the meeting are recorded and have been published, and they're really quite, I don't know how many of you have read them, I'm sure some here have. They're really quite something to read. I'll talk about them a bit. But again, my idea is that not only was proximity and rivalry and the inevitability of group dynamics responsible for these controversies and their vociferousness, but I would also say the context in which the two groups functioned. That's one of my thoughts. And see, what I write here is that while the British and the Austrians were both touched by the war's murderousness, this is from my book, the refugees' relationship to their homeland, from the homeland from which they fled, had a particular influence upon the nature of their professional discourse and their clinical work. The Viennese, in fact, felt attacked from many angles. While these Jewish, often left-leaning refugees were far from being Nazified enemies of Britain, they were aliens in every other sense of the word. Adjusting to a new language, many of them had no English, and cultures, they endured a silence from home, punctuated by vague but ominous rumors of the fate of families stuck in Central Europe. As the bombings eased in 1941 and most of the English returned from the countryside, these refugees were once again outnumbered, another loss for a group that had struggled with a painful sense of foreignness after their arrival, and thus a particular need to establish their unity and solidarity in exile. Now, I'm not suggesting that I can prove that these circumstances influenced the Freud-Klein controversies, not, you know, according to historical truth. Nor would I want to presume a kind of armchair psychoanalysis, which gives psychohistory a bad name, where I start delving into these people's inner lives that I never met and are long dead. But official versions of history often omit a more private reality. The early psychoanalysts, and this is key too, the early psychoanalysts held fast to historical truth. And I think this only intensified because after the Anschluss in Austria, there was even more of a wish to make psychoanalysis a universal science. You know, the way Darwin, and of course, oddly enough, that's being challenged in the 21st century, who knew, but, you know, to try to make scientific truths that transcended context and legitimized psychoanalysis and legitimized the Jewish emigres who made psychoanalysis. So that means when you consult the actual documents, there's very little, almost nothing about their private struggles, and certainly very little reference to how the struggles affected their work. If you ask most of these people, many of whom went to America, as you know, they would say that life in America was wonderful. It was even better than in Europe. They were more successful than they thought they would ever be. They joined up with the prestigious medical profession in America, made more money. But if you read between the lines, and I was able to do this, this is a little detour because this is about America, a social worker named Blumer Swerldorf did private interviews with some of the emigres, Lowenstein, Chris, and Hartman. Interesting that it was a social worker who, you know, and asked them these questions, and many of them said it was terrible, and they were terrified, and they felt, and they talked about what they missed and lost, but almost all of it is omitted from the official transcript. I had to go get special permission to read these. In the U.S. Okay, so, now, let me just continue there. I don't want to leave time for... Now, here's the interesting thing about the business meeting. There's one woman, some of you may know her. Her name is Sylvia Plane. She actually became the head of the British Psychoanalytic Institute after Jones. But at this point, she's just a member... Not just, she's a respected member of the group. And she challenged the traditional idea between ideas and context during the controversial discussions, during they're called extraordinary business meetings, which to me sounds like such a British way to say it. Extraordinary British meetings. And she said this, she made this comment, and she said that, to use the word again, she said, it seems to me that what's going on here is, quote, extraordinarily like that which is taking place in many countries right now. And I feel sure that it is in some way a tiny reverberation of the massive conflict which pervade the world. And then she continued, surely, as first-line psychologists, we can tolerate insight into our collective problems without falling to bits and disintegrating the unit in this way. Now, Payne's efforts were largely ineffectual, even as the parallels became more obvious. For example, when it is suggested in a conciliatory fashion that both the Freudians and the Kleinians assume responsibility for the contentiousness between them, the Viennese analyst Melita Schmidberg, and I'll get to her again soon, accused the British of employing Nazi propaganda tactics, of being like Dr. Goebbels, by repeating time after time the same slogans and the same lies. This is all in the transcript. Schmidberg is enacting, repeating, and this is psychoanalytic talk, she's enacting, repeating rather than understanding her recent history. But she is also doubtlessly reacting as the estranged daughter of Melanie Klein. Imagine this atmosphere. Imagine. And also, her analyst was also part of the talks. Who was her analyst?
Glover.
Right. Thank you. Thank goodness you're here. Edward Glover. And he's trying, you can see he's trying to make things calm, too. He's trying to reconcile the mom and the daughter, whom she regards with open contempt. So Melanie Klein, who came much earlier to England, was invited by Ernest Jones after her mentor, Abraham, died suddenly. Did not feel very much like a refugee at all. She was really ensconced in Britain. And her daughter, Melita Schmidberg, had to come suddenly after the Anschluss, and was in a very different position. So, finally, Pearl King, the editor who helped compile and to help transcribe and compile the minutes of both the extraordinary meetings and the papers that were given in the controversial discussions, later speculated. The battle between Melanie Klein and Anna Freud was perhaps a diversion as well. A diversion from the depression of what had happened, of having had to leave their homeland. There was rather a taboo about talking about it. Now, I attribute that to their love for psychoanalysis as an absolute science, but also their trauma. It was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. It was too much to deal with. They couldn't keep on keeping on if they talked about it. These people gradually started thinking about what might have happened to their relatives. For a while, they thought they hoped they'd gotten away. And most of the Anglo-Jewish organizations, which were very welcoming to the refugees and emigres, especially to the psychoanalysts who they considered scientists, the academics were very welcoming, the Jewish academics. But they similarly avoided talk of what was happening to their people just across the channel, engaging instead in arguments about Zionism in Palestine, if you read the transcripts of the Jewish organizational meetings. In effect, they only allowed their feelings about the Nazis an outlet in domestic factions and quarrels. Indeed, I think, and I said this a moment ago, events closest to us are least open to reflection. Maybe that's why it's taken this long to talk about the impact of the show on psychoanalysis. In the moment, it's security that matters, and survival. The British historian Tony Kushner tells us that the English tradition of, albeit understated, anti-Semitism did not wane in response to the news from Germany, which also made, perhaps, required a good amount of denial and avoidance and silence from the emigres. A survey by a company calling itself Mass Observations reported that a large proportion of the population believed Jews were un-British, and over 55% admitted to feeling hostility to the emigres. In addition, and now here's an interesting tidbit, British scholars and professionals were far from immune to the pseudo-scientific anti-Semitism so exploited by the Nazis. Once viewed as avaricious capitalists, now the Jews were often accused of a different mission: destroy private property and capitalism and overturn the social order. Indeed, after 1917, the notion of a menacing Judeo-Bolshevism, is the term, became as entrenched in Europe as the notions of Jews as Christ killers had been among Europe's Christians. The fascists were hoping to gain support from the middle class who were suffering the depression throughout Europe by accusing the communists and the Jews of causing the economic downfall. So Judaism became tantamount to communism, even though most Jews were not communists by any means, although a few prominent leaders of communism were Jewish. So they exploited that. I mean, even the Duke of Windsor, who later abdicated, made these public statements and was talking about the notion of a third way, neither fascist nor democratic for the British, to avoid communism and the Jews. Now, the psychoanalyst and English translator of Freud's standard edition, James Strachey from London, invoked a bit of the Judeo-Bolshevik myth as he anticipated the first of the extraordinary business meetings between the British and Viennese. In a note to Dr. Glover, English Middlebrooks analyst, he writes that he is in favor of compromise between the groups. They had these private correspondences. What are we going to do with these meetings? However, Strachey ends his note with the following question: Why should fascists, but also bloody foreigners, communists, invade our peaceful, compromising island? Now, we can detect some sarcasm here, and we can also detect the nativist sense of impure, outsider, invader that is typical of any group. Yet Strachey's choice of the word foreigner may have an additional connotation, for it was almost always used in government circles and press releases of the period to refer specifically to European Jews seeking refuge. British periodicals spoke of all Jews as foreigners, so that the one word became code for the other. That's also according to Tony Kushner. We are left with the possibility that Strachey's perhaps sarcastic comments belie a subtle or even not so subtle undercurrent of enmity, in a way typical of British anti-Semitic comments of the era. So they're very present, but they're not overt. They're not loud. And the English-born Jews were not particularly welcoming to the immigrants either, the people in this neighborhood at the time. And those who had been brought closer to complete assimilation publicly opposed what was known as the antisocial behavior of refugees. I read an article in a Jewish periodical in 1942 that they were saying it was terrible, that they had terrible accents, they spoke too loudly, and that speaking in foreign languages should be frowned upon. So in other words, Sylvia Payne's parallels between global and institutional hostilities may have been all too accurate if you consider what was going on outside the doors of the Institute. Now, eventually a solution that prevented the Institute from splitting in two was reached. The members voted to divide training among those separate groups to which all candidates, among three separate groups, one was independent, to which all candidates would be exposed. The compromise was, alas, not without its consequences. Anna Freud, and this is important, subsequently lost hope in Britain as the future center of Freudian psychoanalysis, which is why the Kleinians of London are as famous as they are, and the American ego psychologists are as famous as they are, and placed her aspirations elsewhere in England. British psychoanalyst Gregory Cohan adds that many unaligned British analysts, disturbed by the polarized atmosphere, simply left the Institute. They prefer quiet debate to these wars. Now, psychoanalysis survived nonetheless. I was telling Carol that one of the exciting things about being here is psychoanalysis survived, and I mentioned it to you at the beginning. Even after the dust settled, many, including Anna Freud, remained reticent about what had happened to them personally and professionally during After the Scourge in Europe. I want to comment that upstairs in the Anna Freud room is an original transcript of her famous paper on losing and being lost. Now, that paper was published in 1967, but Jung Bruhl, Elizabeth Jung Bruhl, who wrote a lovely biography of Anna Freud, scholarly but also very rich, says that she began writing that paper as soon as she got here. And it took her many, many years to finish it. She wrote iterations of it. She was suffering from pneumonia after her move here, and it wasn't actually published until 1967. Jung Bruhl also talks about how, towards her death, she was memorizing a poem about losing your youth. But actually, she was not memorizing, she was quoting a poem while she was sick, and instead talked about losing her homeland, a famous poem. Now, today's postmodern helping professional is no stranger to valuing and disclosing unique experiences, both in and out of the consulting room. Viewing our subjectivity as inevitable part of theory making in and out of the consulting room, as I demonstrated myself. But Anna Freud upheld a steady bifurcation of private and public. And again, this was augmented by the hope that psychoanalysis, like she and her cohorts, could remain unaltered by context and subjectivity, really the nightmare of a century. So Robert Coles, who's a famous American child psychiatrist, interviewed Anna Freud and asked her about those days after Hitler came to power and before the Anschluss. And Anna says, "We went from day to day and week to week. We were busy. We were trying hard to do our work," which is what I implied earlier. Now, uncharacteristically, she reveals something which some of you may know. She said it first to him, but it's been disseminated. The day of the Anschluss, after she was detained at Gestapo headquarters, she asked her father, "Wouldn't it be better if we all just killed ourselves?" Now, after her final illness, which is a few years later after the first interview, Coles visits her again and asks her about her work with Holocaust survivors, children of the Holocaust who came to England. Some went to Israel, and many came to England. And here's what she says. "I don't think the readers of our piece would need me to state my abhorrence of the Nazi death camps, and I didn't think we should shed a tear for these survivors. Instead, letting the group's research speak for itself." And this was in response to Cole saying, "You didn't seem to share any of your experiences with these children or contextualize your experience alongside theirs." And she adds, "Remember," she said, "I am an analyst," she says to Coles with a wry smile. One wondered if she is altogether joking, considering what was once at stake. Now, I am going to talk about Winnicott. How times do you get? Great. I am going to talk about Winnicott because he was involved with the controversial discussions, as were the other members of the British Psychoanalytic Institute at the time. So he said, he told in his private letters that he'd learned more than anything about psychoanalysis from Melanie Klein. He appreciated Klein's notions of the phantasmagorical, creative, complex, and ruthless inner life of the infant and child. Yet, as a pediatrician and psychoanalyst, Winnicott had also witnessed the importance of the environment of psychic life, especially the quality of early relationships. You know his famous line, "There's no such thing as a baby," meaning that there's always a mother and a baby. He refused to define himself, therefore, as either Freudian or Kleinian in any narrow sense, wanting to include environmental factors in development without sacrificing either Freud or Klein's hard-won psychoanalytic insights regarding psychic reality. Indeed, Winnicott's experience at the controversial discussions fueled what soon became his unique appreciation for internal fantasy and its interaction with the milieu. In a letter to a friend, Winnicott reflected on the difficulties of the era, noting, I got completely lost in the long controversy that went on during the war and ruined all our scientific meetings. People were fighting and fighting for the rights of Mrs. Klein. It had to be done, but it left me completely cold. The biographer Dodie Goldman explains that the part of what left Winnicott cold about the discussions was, quote, the dogmatic assertions, defensive constructs based more on particular personalities and the politics of the time than on truth about psychoanalysis and experience. Winnicott's awareness of this actual environment is perhaps best illustrated in a moment during which he interrupts the back and forth at the meetings and says, excuse me, I should like to point out that there's an air raid going on outside. They're screaming at each other. He then suggests that it might be wise to seek shelter, but the analyst instead went on fighting, as if nothing was said. Winnicott, and that's according to Adam Phillips. Winnicott ends his comments about the controversial discussions by observing in a letter to a friend, what happened to me was that I began to be interested in the environment, and this has led me to something new. Now, of course, the war itself brought the outside in. It was inevitable, whether a theorist liked it or not. You know, for instance, the war nurseries taught Anna Freud and her colleagues a lot about early relationships. Even though she didn't consider herself an object relations theorist, she learned one of the famous things she learned was the importance of small family groups when children were abandoned or lost parents as easing the trauma. So she learned about, and she also learned about how important the mother-child relations were to the biological and mental functions of children that one might initially have thought of as more innate. And Bowlby, he was sort of kicked out of the psychoanalytic school for a while, did a lot of work on trauma with children and families that helped him to understand separation and loss and attachment. However, what I want to say again, and this was my earlier thesis that I'm bringing back, for the different analytic groups, the environment in London was different. Their variable exposure and vulnerability to the barbarism that transformed the era may have contributed to the ideological distinction that arose between the Viennese, the British, and by extension the American analysts, who the Viennese analysts mostly went to America, Hartmann, Lowenstein, who was French, but Hartmann, Kress, particularly regarding the ways in which they understood and managed, of all things, human destructiveness. How ironically. After witnessing the rewind 20 years before 1930, so it's 1920, after witnessing the unprecedented carnage of World War I, Freud began to question the primacy of libido in psychic life. He also began to challenge the seeming triumph of sublimation of urges, evident in the German high culture of his upbringing, the art, the science, the gymnasium education, all of which nurtured and sustained him. In 1920, he first mentioned a drive beyond the pleasure principle, evidence in the human compulsion to repeat painful experiences. This drive to go backwards, as it were, came to be equated with thanatos later on, or an urge towards death in Freud's revised metapsychology. As an inherently destructive trend, it became the staple of Melanie Klein's theorizing. So this is the seed of the debate. Freud's view was that the death drive is typically fused with such libidinous aims as mastery via repetition. You know, Fort Da, the game that a little child plays that he observes, forward, backward, to try to master loss. And therefore part of the ego's adaptive defenses. His awareness of what we would call the over-determined quality in this motivation led him to postulate that a death drive did not make itself plain in treatment. It was instead left to theorizing. Klein went another direction. Or another way to put it is that Freud's death instinct is clinically quiet while Klein's is noisy. For Klein, the death instinct presents as an irreducible instinctual hate, readily observed in the aggressive play of child patience. Furthermore, if the Freudian child's moral compass is set when he identifies, rather than wishes to destroy his erstwhile rival, the same-sex parent, Klein's infant and toddler are not only possessed of a severe, if rudimentary, hate and love towards the object, but also some very intense sense of right and wrong. How does Klein know as much? According to her, and this is a quote, "Very young children's play exhibits destructive fantasies toward the parents that are in turn met with interjected counteraggression. And this is evidenced in guilt-ridden self-punishment in response of the urge to ruin their parents." Now, these distinctions, as you might imagine, therefore, in fact, impact practice in the consulting room. Anna Freud, following her father's developmental schema, would not link a death drive to a spoiling hate, envy, and guilt in the young child's play. She instead worked to fortify the child's adaptive capacities as he or she began to take on the later developmental conflicts between desire, aggression, competition, guilt, and finally, identification and interjection of parental ideas. Put differently, Anna Freud wished to shore up the patient in order to help develop the nascent superego, while Klein attempted to tone down a harsh, self-punishing version of the child's guilt-ridden murderousness. Now, perhaps because Sigmund Freud's initial introduction of the death drive did not, in the main, show itself in the consulting room, many Freudians felt neither inspired nor compelled to embrace it, even initially. However, Freud's tone towards the notion shifted somewhat when he revised it in 1930. Now, this was a time of mounting anti-Semitism and extremist militaristic challenges to moderate government in Central Europe, particularly in Vienna. As if anticipating what was soon to happen to his own city, he tells us, "Men are not gentle creatures." This is the title of the talk. And he adds, "Anyone who calls to mind the atrocities committed during the racial migration or the invasions of the Huns, or by people known as the Mongols under Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, or at the capture of Jerusalem by the pious crusaders, or even, indeed, the horrors of the recent World War, anyone who calls these things to mind will have to bow humbly before the truth of this view that men are not gentle creatures. Yet bow humbly they did not, and the concept of an innate drive towards death," these are his followers, "and destructiveness, irrespective of the altered version advanced by Klein, became a point of distinction between all analysts, not just Kleinians and Freudians, for years to come, particularly maybe in America, but I think all over Europe. Why would this be so? Asked why he thought the concept of Thanatos was unpopular in the mainstream, the Czech-born Freudian analyst Martin Bergman replied that when psychoanalysis was exported, it was sanitized by Freud's followers, most of whom were deeply loyal to Anna Freud, who was deeply loyal to her father. The psychoanalyst and Holocaust survivor Dori Laub, he was Romanian, identifies the same linkage, but much more pointedly. Post-war psychoanalysts, especially émigrés, who are most of the theorists, had a difficult time with the Holocaust. They used theory as an armor against it. Bergman told me, however, that he was one of the few in New York who believed in the death instinct. He was one of the few who spoke up. And here's why. Because it's the only possible explanation for the Holocaust, he told me. Nothing else was, we thought could have prepared us for it. In our youths in Europe, we thought anti-Semitism was decreasing. We were very idealistic about new ideas and new forms of government. We really believed in the future. Acceptance or refusal of the death instinct was a defining crucible between analysts then, and in some ways it remains so today. It was not until the end of the last century that life and death drives began to be viewed as existing in dynamic conflict with one another among more Freudian people, so that the complex relationship between these drives, early object relationships, and the environment are all now embraced as determinants of a life and a mind. But what of that debate, the longer debate throughout the 20th century? Consider that when Freud wrote and published Civilization and Its Discontents, he still enjoyed freedom and prestige in Vienna. That was 1930, quote. And social and geographic distance from the full brunt of human destructiveness. Later on, he got many requests. He was ill, but he got many requests to write something about anti-Semitism in England, which apparently was mounting. There was a periodical called Time and Tide that wanted him to write something. There were other literary magazines that wanted him to write something, and he refused them all. And there's a very famous quote, which I didn't include here, but it's in my book because I wanted to leave time for discussion, where he talks about all he'd been through, and he didn't have it in him to discuss it. And he said, maybe somebody else with more strength. He was also dying of jaw cancer, but both are true. So I suggest that he had more psychic space earlier in his life to explore the darker realm, a psychic region that proved too close for comfort for him and his compatriots, including his daughter, only a few years later. Distances matter. They can mean life or death. They can mean insight, trauma, and omission. When we consider all that went into the debates personally, professionally, the controversial discussions and the extraordinary business meetings, what happened in the British Psychoanalytic Society becomes more understandable, I think. We should observe that the famous compromise became a most important benchmark in the slow evolution of psychoanalysis towards a more pluralistic and tolerant community. Yet the irony remains. The emigres had available to them a theory that would have provided an avenue for understanding the terrible ordeal they had undergone. And they didn't take it. No matter whether we think of Sigmund Freud's version, Miss Klein's, or of some other modified version of either, some discussion of the death instinct, some identification of a basic root of human destructiveness would seem to have been what the situation called for at the time. Yet the theoretical opening was determinedly refused. As was the plea for inclusiveness and expanded ideas, even as England became the refuge from which psychoanalysis fought for and attained its status in both England and America. So I'm going to end with what I started with. Perhaps our theories not only satisfy our curiosity and answer our questions, both theoretical and clinical, but also our need for security. They both expand our awareness and occasionally and always contract or limit it. So I'll stop there. Because of what I would really like to do is to know.
Things that is important to think about, particularly in regard to the controversial discussions, that when you've lost something, like Anna Freud and lost her hold, there is a need to what you've lost becomes rigid, you know, your theories and your thoughts become somehow rigidified. You can't move away from them because something you have lost, you have to hang on to much more. And I think that was what didn't give them the freedom.
Yes, yes, I completely agree. By the way, this is Lydia Tischler. She's a child analyst who studied with Anna Freud and is also a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah.
Mm, so I'm very honored that you came to my talk. Any other?
I'd just like to ask out of curiosity, really, if you talk to anyone who knew Ferenczi.
Who knew Ferenczi? Not anyone who knew. Well, you know, the institute where I got my psychoanalytic training, the William Allison White Institute in New York, was started by Clara Thompson, who was in analysis with Ferenczi, because as an interpersonalist, she and her compatriot, Harry Steph Sullivan, wanted to be analyzed. And, you know, in those days there were very little few analysts. And the only analysts in New York were Freudian. They were mostly people who had gone to Vienna to be analyzed by Freud and his followers. So Harry Steph Sullivan said, the only person you can go to in the whole of Europe is Ferenczi. So she did. And she told a lot of stories about him. Why do you ask?
Oh, I've always rather liked him, and I agree with him. I mean, I'm aware of the Jones attitude towards him, and eventually sidelining.
That's
him.
Right.
I'm on Ferenczi's side, right, in regard to object relations theory.
Yes.
Particularly also the way that he pointed out the theatrical relations. I know. Yes, I mean, the pointing out actually in relation to the name of the father and so on, that actually the child relates much more initially to the mother.
That's right, yeah. Right, well, it took the Freudians a long time, although Anna Freud is to some important degree responsible for shifting, because she studied young children in their early relationships. But you're right. I mean, the other thing about Ferenczi is that Ferenczi basically suggested that what really happens really matters, and not just what's going on in fantasy and intrapsychically. And that's how I was trained, which is part of what brought me to this topic.
Can you just say a little bit about how you went about the research, about the interviews that you did with the different people that you quote in the book, and whether some of them actually, I mean, given the line of your questioning, whether people were willing to be interviewed by what their reactions were?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I mean, I felt like I was racing against time, because many of the people who I was very anxious to interview were quite old and even sick. And as a matter of fact, Henry Crystal, I don't know if those of you who are analysts study him, he really was, in many ways, the father and the mother of trauma theory. Even though he was trained as a classical Freudian analyst, he had to refer to his theory as a psychotherapeutic theory, not a psychoanalytic theory. He wrote a book called Massive Psychic Trauma, and he talked about the impact on thinking and personality of even adult-onset trauma, which was really revolutionary since the psychosexual developmental line of Freudian psychoanalysis occurs much earlier in adult. Adult trauma is supposed to be experienced only as it relates to early development. So Henry Crystal gave me a wonderful interview, because he's actually Polish and was in Auschwitz. And by the time it came, the book was published and I wanted to send him a copy, his wife called me and said, he can't read anymore, he can't even speak. And I felt so grateful that I had gotten a chance to talk to him about his childhood and how it affected his ideas and the way he was shunned early on in psychoanalysis and only later embraced. Martin Bergman, Prague, from the Czech Republic, whose father was Hugo Bergman, the famous philosopher and best friend of Kafka, died about a few weeks after approving my interviews, because I didn't publish anything without their approval. Most people were eager to tell their stories. One person said that nobody had ever asked him these questions and was remarkably open and disclosing, more so than his reputation, Otto Kernberg. ever, ever would suggest. In fact, many people, when they read my book, say, the first thing they ask me is, how did you get out of Cranbrook to say all this? And I said, I think it's because nobody had ever asked him, and he was full of stories. Like, he told me the story of Indiana having to watch his mother kneel down and scrub the street in front of their apartment. He told me many stories, and people say, how did you get him to talk this way? How did you get him to talk this way? And I didn't do anything. I just asked him, I think, the right questions. A couple of people were offended by what I had written. Even some people insisted that I didn't, they never said what they said, and even though I had it on tape. And I think this was because they felt very exposed and very, Anton Chris, he told me things about his father, Ernst Chris, who was very, very close to Anna Freud. And the children, Anna also, I think, who was named after Anna, and Tony, considered really Freud, Anna Freud, another parent. She watched over them, and they would have likely have stayed in England if not for the Blitz. They really preferred England, but they were young children. He told me lots of things about his father's life in England, about his father, that he insisted he never said and was very angry at me and wanted to actually revoke his testimony. Instead, what I begged him to keep the testimony, and I said I would simply omit what he didn't want me to say. So that, and I think that has something to do with trauma too. In other words, you know, sort of what you don't know, you know, or what you don't want to know, you know. Because it's so overwhelming and so provocative that you either need to block it out or revise it repeatedly. But mostly it was an incredibly moving experience. And one guy, Henry Perrins, who was in his 90s and was a French survivor, told me that he only, and this was the term he used, he said, I only came out as a survivor in the 90s. And he said, and I'm not gay, but I'm talking to you about how it felt to present these kinds of things in a psychoanalytic institute. He was actually in Philadelphia. And he would do a lot of parent education, which Anna Freud did as well, and was frowned upon for doing parent education by his psychoanalytic colleagues. And didn't want to say, look, the reason I want to do this is because the reason I'm not crazy and the reason I grew up to have a productive, meaningful life as a psychiatrist is because of how my mother loved me. Because what I suffered and what I went through, I don't believe I would have survived otherwise. And that's why he thought the quality of the relatedness between mother and child was so important. And spent most of his life working on that. So he said he came out in the 90s. That answers some of the... Yes.
Your thesis is a very interesting one about the way in which the analysts are unable to actually engage the parts. And the only person in a sense you've mentioned who is, you know, says well outside being a Jewish immigrant is Winnicott. Surely other people within the Amit movement who do not come from Jewish emigre background at least raise that question? If not, you've got the question in a sense, why didn't they raise the question about the emigres?
Well, firstly, you just made me think of something incredibly important which passed by me, and thank you, that Winnicott's the one who says there's an Arab going on. You know, that he's, but, you know, there actually was a real distinction between the British analysts and most of the analysts in Europe. And that is that the British analysts were largely not Jewish. And the European analysts almost all were Jewish. And that is part of the clash that I mean. So basically, British analysis, aside from Anna Freud, was very heavily dominated by object relations theorists and Melanie Klein, whereas the Freudians went to America and were mostly all Jewish. So that's part of the split. And most of the many of the analysts in France were Jewish. Why is that? Well, some people say Stephen Frosch, whose books are in the who I think is wonderful, and this bookster in the bookstore, writes a lot about this, and he says, because being a psychoanalyst is a lot like being a Jew. You have to be effectively inside and outside at the same time. You're part of the culture, and yet you're outside the culture. It gives you a very particular insight. So you're a participant, and you're an observer. And as much as psychoanalysis is based on the relationship, the transference, counter-transference, but it's also based on being able to stand back and sort of witness and interpret what the person's doing, it really is a Jewish science.
So what are you saying about the non-Jewish, the English analysts?
Well, they mostly rejected
but didn't they see
European immigrants.
Yeah, but... When they're talking about the emigres, did any of their reflections turn on just the issue about the context, what had happened in Europe?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the history of ideas. I think positivism and historical truth was much more the way people did research and the way people taught and thought. And then this kind of relational turn and postmodern turn where everything was subjective and contextual is much more recent. And so I don't think people thought it scholarly or acceptable to really speak about context in the way that we do now. In fact, they would have thought of that as pseudoscientific. So, I'm a product of my time. I could write this book now and have it accepted by a publisher and sold and bought because the zeitgeist of my time allows it. I'm not sure you could write that way about theory in those days because theory was thought of as a kind of truth, as a kind of absolute. And I'm not sure that anybody would be accepted. That would be viewed more as a personal attack. That's my thought about it.
I'm not talking about theory. I mean, at least...
Or practice.
At least recognizing... what those people who have come to the continent have been through.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the other thing I would say is that nobody in the Western world could quite face it. I think there was various levels of trauma, but nobody in the Western world really thought and talked about it much. I mean, I remember going to Vienna in the 80s and looking desperately for Freud's house on Burgasse 19. And I remember that we couldn't find it, me and my friend who's also a psychoanalyst. And I thought, well, maybe it's because I don't have any German. So I opened the Michelin and I showed the address so that I didn't think that, I was mispronouncing it. Everybody I met went like this. I mean, no person could tell me where this street was. And when I went to France... And I went in the 80s when I was a student, and I went, they had a Holocaust memorial on the Ile de la Cité, underground. It's still there. Not one word in the whole memorial mentioned Jews, mentioned the concentration camps. It's a war memorial to the dead. Now, if you go to France, and many of you I'm sure have been, there's an above ground Shoah memorial, very beautiful, with pillars, with actually my family's names are on the pillar, my daughter, who's here, first showed me because she went before me and took pictures of their names. And there's a museum with permanent and temporary exhibits, because now is now and then was then.
I would like to add to that in Auschwitz, the old barracks. Have been given to different countries that had Jews deported from those countries to the camp. And I'm from Holland, and the barrack that was furnished by the Dutch didn't mention the Jews at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was all about the resistance and how the Dutch population suffered under the occupation.
Right.
And then things started falling apart and something had to be done, so it was given as a project to member of my family.
Oh.
And he totally revised it. The big thing was that then for the first time it was the story of the Jews of Holland.
Yes.
That were deported to Auschwitz. There was no Brandenburg before.
Right, well that's a great point. I think part of that is communism, which didn't want to make religious differentiations, and Poland was communist, where Auschwitz was, as a museum. I think the other part of it is that...
I don't understand that part.
I think that the Auschwitz Museum was in Poland.
Yeah.
And in Poland, which was Soviet at the time, it was a matter of principle not to make distinctions based on religion. So the Jews were seen as just Soviet. And that part, the fall of communism, helped to get rid of that. I think, though, the other reason, which you're alluding to, and I agree with completely, is that it was easier for people to think of the Shoah as another kind of warfare. Because that they could absorb. You know, there were countries fighting with each other, and some were interned in this barbaric way. The idea that there could be a scientific and very efficient and very determined genocide against a particular group for no particular reason, not for land, not for power, I think was very hard for people to stomach for a very long time, and not just Jews. I think the 20th century, which, you know, believed in the same things Martin Bergman said, in, you know, the future and science and industry and things getting better and better, didn't quite accept that this is what we were brought to. And it had nothing to do with resistance to invasion, it had nothing to do with gaining power and politics, it had to do with targeting a subgroup of people and destroying them systematically, which they really did, which they succeeded at doing. So,
of course.
Not quite. Thank goodness.
But they tried.
They tried. And,
yes.
And they...
And it wasn't for no reason. I mean, Hitler produces...
Right, but no territory.
Not an objective.
Not an objective reason for which people fight wars.
Yeah.
For which people fight wars.
I just wanted to ask you something about America.
Yeah.
In connection sort of with Israel, you mentioned emigration and psychoanalysis in Palestine, and there was a talk here, I don't know when it was, about a year ago maybe, somebody talking about pre-state Israel, Palestine, Yishuv, and the situation of emigres of the psychoanalytic movement moving there. And on the one hand, having the tension between the wish for the focus on the individual and all that that entails, and on the other hand, rebuilding a society and the focus community and the rejection of everything past. In other words, the image of a passive Jew who is a victim, but all that goes with that in terms of ideology and then the process. I just wondered how you spoke a bit about those who went to America, and in a sense, the American melting pot was maybe to some extent a similar paradigm, how that worked out.
It was similar. I wonder if you're referring to my friend Aaron Melnick. Who wrote Freud and Zion? Is that the guy?
You would maybe remember. I think maybe that was him. I can't remember.
Yeah. That's a great book.
I can't remember his name. He was here about
it. He was very generous with me when I called him, because at that point his book was not translated when I wrote my book. It was not translated from Hebrew. I have no Hebrew. And so he talked to me and translated a lot. And he's wonderful. And then I brought him to America to speak at my institute. I would say a few things. I would say that's absolutely true, that in some ways being introspective and individualistic and even the tragic European vision, which is maybe also a Jewish vision, is antithetical to everything Israeli, to the new Jew, you know, who is going to be strong and physical and empowered and make a great future. My take on that, though, which I find very poignant, is that while Eidington tried to get with that program, because Eidington was always a Zionist, he came from an industrialist family in Europe, and that's why he was so wealthy and could really bankroll Freud to a large degree. That's what he did in Jerusalem. But strangely enough, most of the Berlin analysts who went to Israel, now some of them were also very leftist, and that's part of why they left early, like Bernfeld, and there were a couple of others, Moshe Wolf. They went because they wanted, they left long before they had to leave, because when the fascist government started, they felt so out of place. So they left more as leftists than as Jews, although they were both. But after the war, many of these people were so steeped in their history that many of the Israelis spoke, I use that term, the third generation of Berlin analysts. That's the Israelis' term for those people. Do you know that the meetings of the Institute, up until the 1960s, were all written in German, not Hebrew? And the most important thing, and Hillel Klein, you may or may not be familiar with, and his protege, Eleni Kogan. I spoke with Hillel Klein, died tragically young, but Eleni Kogan, his protege, to whom he passed the mantle, told me that, because I interviewed her, told me that people would come to her in their 40s and 50s, many of them are analysts, and they had had these long analyses in Israel with reputable people, some of whom were trained by Freud and his followers, and they didn't feel better, and they didn't feel good. And she began to talk to them about their parents' Holocaust trauma. Because many of them had parents from Europe who, and a whole world opened up to them. This was not until the 1980s. And her book is called The Cry of Mute Children, and she does case studies. So things in Israel were difficult in many ways similar to, and in other ways different. Anna Ornstein, for instance, who's an American self-psychologist analyst from Hungary, when she started her analysis in Cincinnati at the very Freudian Institute, very ex-Freudian Institute, wanted her analysts to know about her experiences in the camps, but it was hard for her to talk about them. So she wrote out like a 10-page story. She gave it to him. This is her interview with me. She gave it to him and he gave it back to her and said, I don't do that. I don't read things you write. So then she gave it to his secretary, and his secretary mailed it back to her. And she gave it to the secretary and said, just keep it, maybe one day he'll read it. And she has a husband, Paul Ornstein, who's also a famous self-psychologist, who she knew actually before the Shoah. He was in conscripted labor, while she was in Auschwitz. And when she got out of Auschwitz, she told him her story in Hungary for hours and hours and hours. And she could tell him because he was from her town. And she felt close to him. And she feels very much that saved her life. And that was part of why she wanted to write it out for her analyst. And this was like in the 50s, 1950s.
Can I just make a comment? A personal experience, I went, not about the analysts in Israel, but I went to Israel in 1960, having had an analysis as part of my training with Anna Freud. And I visited the kibbutz, where I met a lot of people whom I had known in Terezin, in one of the camps. Ah. And I immediately, my point of contact was that I knew them in camp. So when I met them and said hello, and started talking about, because that was our relationship, what happened in Terezin. And my guide, who had lived in Israel, who didn't go through the Holocaust, tried to stop me. And when we went back, he told me, Lydia, we do not talk about things that happened in camp. And it was in fact, Israel had a taboo. It was, considering how many psychologists there were in Israel, it was so anti-psychological to get people to repress, to forget. And it was only with the Eichmann trial that the Holocaust could be thought about and talked about.
Before, can we, she just had her hand up and then I'll...
No, I was just making the comparison, asking you about how that Israeli model works itself out in America, given the sort of similar tests between the individual and what he feels society and merge different identities and possibly, to some extent, lessen those that have come.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't really answer your question. It's a very good question.
You did ask
for it. I mean, here's what I would say. You know, Freud hated America, you all know that. He only went once. Speaking of Ferenczi, Ferenczi used the money that he made on his Bell's-Clark lectures to buy a huge villa in Buda, in Budapest. Mm-hmm. And it's only recently been bought back. I spoke there, so I know. Sorry. So that was the one trip. That was the one trip he made, the one and only. I mean, he was sick the whole time. I was talking with Carol earlier about how he always loved Britain, in part. Carol reminded me because he had older half-brothers in Britain.
Yep.
And, you know, so being here, he was extremely happy. And if you read his diaries, it's really tragic that he died so soon after, although he was an old man, because he loved it here. But so I think that Freud was right. I think Freud was right about America. And I think that when psychoanalysis was quote-unquote medicalized, because the psychiatrists could all be part of the medical organizations, and they could make a lot of money. It had a small heyday in the 50s and 60s, but it's always been on the margins. I think a lot because America's a youth culture, America's about progress, America's about having and not being. And I stole that. Apologies to Eric Fromm, who is from who's an emigre from Germany, from the Holocaust. And I think that not only that, but I think that it's even worse now than it ever was. There was a period, I think, when not just because of it being earlier in the history, but I think there was a time not just because of it being medicalized, but there was a time when the emigres came that they were considered sort of golden because they were Freud's heirs apparent. They had touched Freud. They had known Freud. Hans Hartmann was one of his best friends. And so there was a general interest in psychiatry, in who are these people and what do they have to teach us? Whereas those before were considered sort of secondhand, were considered, you know, imposters because they hadn't actually been in Europe. But that waned over time. So I think it's a great analogy. I think it's a good point. Yeah. But can she just... Sure. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused with my thinking that you're right to say that in Palestine at the time they wanted to adopt German as a national language and not Hebrew. That's number one. But then number two, Einstein urged Freud to write an encouraging letter to the pioneers that were at the time in Palestine.
Right.
And Freud refused. And in the 70s, Anna Freud was invited to come to Israel and present one of her papers. And she refused. And at the time, I think Freud was not interested so much in Zionism, because in 1934, I think he wrote the book on Moses.
Yeah.
That was an Egyptian prince.
Yeah.
And when he came to England, he was so eager to publish the book. It was an unfortunate relationship. I don't want to blame him, to blame anybody. But the Europeans were not encouraged to come to Israel at the time.
True.
And contribute to the culture. On the contrary, they tried to disengage from this culture.
That's true. You know, I think that's true. I think that has a lot to do with what I said earlier, which is that they were really hoping for a universal science. You know, they had so much there are a lot of different responses to anti-Semitism in Europe. One, of course, was Zionism, but that was not the most popular one until after the Shoah. You know, a more popular one was to become a cosmopolitan universalist and transcend your birth and be a person of letters and a sophisticated, you know, member of humanity. And, you know, that the tragedy of that, of course, was the Shoah. Many of these European analysts were raised without any observance, even though they were Jewish. They went to gymnasiums, they went to universities, and in a weird way, essentializing them as Jews was a lot like what the Nazis tried to do. That's right. But it's also maybe not fair to us, for us to do that to them, because they were not Jewish identified. I mean, I have a funny story. Martin Freud was married, and they decided that he should be married in a synagogue. I think it had something to do with his wife. And she was Jewish. Why was that? Because those were the social circles, you know.
They forced them to marry Jews at the time.
Right, well, this was later.
They forced them to get married in a synagogue.
Maybe. He had, so he's walking down the aisle, and he takes his hat off because he thinks it's polite. He had no idea that you cover your head. He'd never seen a yarmulke or a kippah. Even though his mother came from an Orthodox Jewish family, his father was Jewish, Jacob Freud was fairly observant, because that was not their identity. And, you know, I mean, we can't be like the Nazis. Now, some people do accuse some of these people of being self-hating Jews. I think that that's revisionist history. I think that we have the benefit of time to say, look, you silly people, you thought you could pass, you thought you could make it, look what happened to you. I think that's presumptuous and revisionist, you know. The reason for having Israel certainly became clearer in my mind after the Shoah, but, you know, that's something else instead.
In some countries, I don't want to mention names, they teach a psychoanalysis, and they go out of the way to say that Freud, hated it, that psychoanalysis should be divorced from Judaism, because the Jews themselves alienated themselves from this religion.
Really?
Yeah. And this is a new way of thinking.
That's strange.
Yeah, it is.
Because, you know, Freud was a proud Jew, very proud Jew. He considered himself a Jew. He never made any bones about it. He spoke to the B'nai B'rith, and he wasn't observant. He didn't partake of the religious rituals, nor was he aligned religiously. But his favorite jokes were Yiddish jokes. He had, you know, and I think Anna Freud was, there's a funny line in a Kohut biography, you know, Heinz Kohut, who also escaped in the nick of time to Chicago, but was not at all Jewish identified. There's a funny line in his biography by Charles Sproger where she says she wants to go shopping, and Heinz says to her, well, I guess you like the bargains here and you like the variety. She said, no, it's the Jew in me.
Actually, I'm glad you returned to Anna Freud, because I wanted to say that I think her turning away from the British society and turning towards America was perhaps partly to do with the controversial discussions, but it was also because she wanted to set up a training for child analysts, and the institute wouldn't let her because they insisted that you had to train as an adult analyst before you could train as a child analyst, and therefore she set up the Hempstead training where she trained child analysts, although she wasn't allowed to call us analysts because we were not trained at the institute. And curiously enough, one of the main objectors was Winnicott.
Objector.
He also objected to setting up a training only for child analysts. And I think that must have been quite an important reason for her to leave the institute, as it were, and set up on her own in her Masfield Gardens. And because she wasn't part of the NHS, the money came mainly from America.
Hmm. That's a mistake in my book. I wish I'd known that. I wish I'd spoken to you. I think it makes a lot of sense.
It's in Jan Brill's biography.
Ah. Okay. Yeah, was the, yeah. I must have missed that part.
Final questions. I'm sure anyway, you know, time to discuss and talk afterwards. Any last comments? If not, I'd just really like to thank Emily for a fascinating insight, shedding light on such a difficult and complex and complicated area. I think the discussion has shown quite how complex it is and how thoughtful and sensitive one needs to be before jumping to conclusions. And thank you for giving us the kind of insight of your research, which is so interesting. And thank you to Lydia Tischler as well for coming along and offering her personal comments and insights as well.
And thank you so much for having me.
Well, we'll thank ourselves. Thank you.
No, I think that's really true. I should have thought of that. It's also, but it makes sense because Klein really thought adult analysis was the same as child analysis.
And Melanie was terribly, she felt that she had to interview adult analysis in order for it to be recognized as analysis. And that's why she was reading.
Yes. It's in the book. Right?
Yes, it is. It is.
Thank you for your comments. My daughter's going to Amsterdam for her university. She's a university student and she's going to Amsterdam for 4 months. 5 months. I like to think it's 4 months. I'm going to miss her. Thank you for your expressions of interest. It's very inspiring.
Masters at Berkeley, and Stephen was my current vice chancellor.
Oh, wow.
So I've got a few of his books.
I wish he had my book. I quote him
repeatedly. I'm surprised he wasn't here, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I could be had a lot of mothers concerned.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And what's your name?
Thank you.
If you read Anna Freud, this is something she has thought about.